mobile or download the brand new app. To start your BBC iPlayer radio journey, go to the Radio 3 website.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high definition sound. It's 1 o'clock, just gone. And if you've recently tuned in, a very good afternoon to you from me, Jonathan Swain. In a couple of minutes, today's early music show exploring the music of Tartini, the man famous for that Devil's Trill violin sonata. First, there was a summary of the news. The former pop star Gary Glitter has been arrested by police officers investigating the sexual assault allegations surrounding Jimmy Savile. Glitter, whose real name is Paul Gadd, was driven away from his home in central London this morning. Scotland Yard says a man in his 60s is being questioned on suspicion of sexual offences, and more arrests are expected over the coming days. The chairman of the BBC Trust, Lord Paton, has expressed his determination to deal with the scandal involving Jimmy Savile once and for all. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, he said the corporation was at risk of losing the public's trust and must face up to the truth about itself. A bomb has exploded in the Catholic Church in Kaduna in northern Nigeria, killing at least 8 people and injuring many others. The region has seen a series of sectarian attacks, many of them carried out by the Islamist group Boko Haram. The United States is bracing itself for one of the biggest storms to hit the East Coast for many years. Hurricane Sandy, which has led to 60 deaths in the Caribbean, is now around 800 miles wide. 8 states, including New York and Pennsylvania, have declared a state of emergency. Britain has expressed its grave concern to the government in Burma about the sectarian violence in the western state of Rakhine. At least 20,000 people have been forced from their homes, most of them Muslims from the Rohingya community. In a statement, the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, urged the Burmese authorities to allow humanitarian aid into the region. The authorities in eastern China have said that work to expand a chemical plant will be halted after a demonstration by thousands of residents concerned about pollution. Yesterday, protesters clashed with riot police in the city of Ningbo. A search is continuing for the skipper of a yacht found beached on the Isle of Wight. The boat was discovered near Bryston yesterday with its engine still running. And the weather, a cloudy, wet and rather windy day. The rain will be heavy at times in the west, with the odd brighter spell possible in the east. Top temperatures, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, 7 to 8 in Scotland. And that's the news and the weather, with the time coming up to 3 minutes past one. Which means it's time now here on Radio 3 for today's edition of the Early Music Show. It's introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
A short excerpt from one of the most extraordinary pieces in the violin repertoire, the so-called Devil's Trill Sonata, played there in a historic recording by Yehudi Menuhin. And we'll have the chance to hear more of it in a more modern recording a little later on. Its composer is Giuseppe Tartini, a violinist, composer and music theorist who's the subject of today's early music show. Perhaps it is this devilish work that's made him most famous today, but there's much more to Tartini than that. Indeed, although the overwhelming majority of his output was violin music, his innovations in style and technique, not to mention his personal philosophy when it came to the very nature of music itself, make him a figure of great importance, and not just to violinists. So who was Tartini? Well, he was born in Pirano, which is now part of Slovenia, on the Adriatic coast, in 1692, which makes him a slightly younger contemporary of that other great composer-violinist, Vivaldi. But you could say that there the resemblance ends. Unlike Vivaldi, Tartini never diversified into theatre works or large-scale church music, and he wasn't so much of a people person than a modest private individual, secretive even. He was passionately interested in not just music, but astronomy and acoustics, and even fencing, in which he apparently became quite a champion. Tartini's parents had wanted him to enter the priesthood, but at the age of 16, he travelled to Padua to study law. 2 years later, having married and then dumped his wife, Elisabetta, he fled south to Assisi, and it was here that he began to build a reputation as a violinist. His first publication in 1728 was a collection of 6 violin concertos. Here's the first movement from number 1.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Fulfish was the soloist there in the first movement of Tartini's Violin Concerto in G minor, Opus 1, Number 1. The Raglan Baroque players were directed by Nicholas Kramer. It's a typical example of a Tartini concerto movement, you could say, fresh, melodic, and certainly virtuosic. But for technique to really startle the senses, we need to turn again to the sonata which began the programme, The Devil's Trill, and the story behind it. Legend has it that it was hearing the great violinist Veracini performing in Florence in the summer of 1716 that so impressed Tartini that he decided to lock himself away to perfect his own playing. When he emerged, it was with a vastly improved technique, wonderful control of cantabile playing or singing style, and thanks to a longer bow and thicker strings with a much bigger tone, both of which he championed for the rest of his career. The Devil's Sonata takes its name from the infamous passage in the third and final movement, which we're going to hear in a moment. Certainly a fiendish section involving almost impossible stretches and trilling at the same time as holding down double stops. He described it in the score with the words, "Devil's trill at the foot of the bed." "One night," he wrote, "I dreamt that I'd made a pact with the devil. I found myself handing my violin to him to see if he might manage some pretty tunes. But imagine my astonishment when I heard a sonata so unusual, so beautiful and performed with such mastery I never thought possible. I was so overcome that I stopped breathing and awoke. Immediately I seized my violin, hoping to recall some shred of what I'd just heard, but in vain. The piece I then composed is without doubt my best, but it still falls short of the one that stunned me. I would have smashed my violin and given up music forever if I could but possess it."
Thank you.
Andrew Manzi with the final movement of Tartini's Devil's Trill Sonata. Of course, the more cynical amongst us might suspect that Tartini's story of the satanic dream that inspired it was a brilliant bit of PR. But it wasn't published until after his death, and anyway, Tartini was a modest, religious man and generally quite secretive about his musical inspirations. And he could also write sweet, lyrical melodies that imitated the human voice, many of them inspired by the poetry of Petrarch, Tasso or Metastasio. We're going to hear part of his violin concerto in A, which is an example of just how hard it is to date his pieces, because he would return to the original manuscripts time and time again, adding or deleting bars or sections, even replacing an entire movement, like this one, which was added to the work some time later. It's inspired by lines of Metastasio. In streams, in fountains and in rivers run bitter tears until my harsh anger is consumed. Giuliano Carmignola was the soloist in the second movement of Tartini's Violin Concerto in A with the Venice Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Andrea Marcon. So Tartini could do devilish drama and fury with a lightning leap of the bow, but he could also express the calm and sublime with slow-moving, passionate lines. His works can certainly be extraordinarily difficult to play, and as a violinist I can personally vouch for that. But unlike some of his contemporaries, for him it was less about showmanship and more about finding the true or the pure nature of music. For the sonata we're going to hear now, he again drew upon poetry to set the scene, this time the libretto of Metastasio's opera Didone Abbandonata, Dido Abandoned. The first movement represents Dido's betrayal in a plaintive and haunting melody that sings of past happiness. The brief second movement vividly shows her furious she realises that Aeneas is really not coming back. But it's the final movement that's Tartini's masterstroke, a gently swaying melody so simple, folk-like even, but also so bleak that you can really feel Dido's thoughts of suicide.
Thank you.
Didone Abbandonata, an evocation of the story of the abandoned Dido in a violin sonata by Giuseppe Tartini, played by Rodolfo Richter with the Palladian Ensemble. Tartini's lines are so lyrical and so very singable that one wonders what he might have produced had he chosen to go down the Vivaldi route into opera. "I have been asked to write for the Opera House of Venice," he wrote, "but I always refused, knowing all too well that a human throat is not a violin fingerboard." And indeed it was the violin that absorbed him almost exclusively throughout his life, which is strange perhaps because, according to his writings in his various learned and some thought almost unfathomable treatises on music, Tartini wrote how the perfection of performance lay within the human voice, which he called a natural phenomenon, in contrast to instrumental music, which he called artificial means. So it wasn't words but melody, he felt, that had the power to express all the emotions necessary to move the listener. Well, earlier on we heard a movement from one of his violin concertos, and now we're going to hear a whole concerto, number 12 in B-flat from his Opus 1. And it's another work that makes great technical demands on the soloist, who, once again, is Elizabeth Fulfish.
Thank you.
Violin Concerto in B-flat, Opus 1, No. 12 by Tartini, played there by Elizabeth Falfish with the Raglan Baroque Players, directed by Nicholas Kramer. Well, time's almost up, I'm afraid, but we're going to end today with one of the few pieces Tartini wrote for the church. I guess when it comes to settings of the Stabat Mater, one instantly thinks of Pergolesi. So it's a surprise to come across this beautiful and rarely heard setting by Tartini. Charles Burney tells us that towards the end of his life, Tartini played only very rarely, other than in the Church of St. Anthony of Padua, to whom he had devoted himself since 1722. After suffering a stroke at the age of 76, Tartini spent his last years composing music that was in great contrast to the fantastical, virtuosic style that had made him famous throughout Europe. And keen to pass on his principles to the next generation, he founded a music school in Padua, the School of Nations, he called it, because it attracted so many students from all over Europe. His Stabat Mater takes inspiration from a feeling of simple, humble piety. Just an organ and string bass provide the accompaniment, while the voices alternate between a kind of recitation and traditional Gregorian chant. So quite a different kind of sound to end today's programme. But even here we can still perceive the style of a composer for whom melody, and most of all the ability to touch the emotions in a straightforward and natural way, was the most important thing.
Thank you.
The Stabat Mater by Giuseppe Tartini, performed by sopranos Isabelle Poulenard and Isabelle Desrochers, and the countertenor Martin Oro, with Stradivaria, directed by Daniel Couillet. The plain chant singer was Bruno Lelevreur. Today's early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping. Well, a few words now from Donald MacLeod about his new Composer of the Week.
Charles Koechlin is a fascinating figure who's fallen down one of those strange holes in musical history. He's a man who ploughed his own furrow, inspired by a number of obsessions: photography, medieval music, and the starlets of the silver screen. He's worth remembering on two counts: as the possessor of one of the most magnificent beards in musical history, and as the composer of a fascinating series of symphonic poems inspired by Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. Join me in rediscovering the unique musical world of Charles Koechlin, my Composer of the Week, every weekday at noon and again at 6:30 in the evening here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this Sunday afternoon. It's just gone 1 minute past two. And now our Sunday concert, recorded recently in London and presented by Martin Handley.
Hello and welcome to the Barbican Concert Hall in London for a performance of what Beethoven, not a man to bandy about empty slogans, said was his greatest work, the Missa Solemnis. This autumn, Sir John Eliot Gardner is the mastermind behind a European and American tour of two Beethoven programmes, the other one focusing on the Ninth Symphony with his Monteverdi Choir and Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, together with four soloists, who today are Lucy Crowe, Jennifer Johnston, James Gilchrist and Matthew Rose. It was when Beethoven heard that his friend, supporter and only composition student, the Archduke Rudolf, was to be elevated to the position of Archbishop of Olmütz that he decided he would write a mass for the occasion. So the Missa Solemnis was both unsolicited and uncommissioned, and it missed its deadline by well over 3 years, demanding more time and thought than anything else Beethoven ever wrote. Before he started, he made a study of the speech rhythms of Latin words and of the choral works of Palestrina, Handel and Bach. Composing the mass itself became a wrestling match. A friend went to visit Beethoven and heard him singing parts of a fugue, howling and stamping. He finally came to unlock the door, his face distorted and frightening, looking as though he was possessed by music and had been in mortal combat. Well, when 3 years late, Beethoven finally sent a beautifully bound score off to the Archduke, the dedication Rudolf saw when he opened the volume may have surprised him. It was very direct and very personal. Beethoven had simply written, "From the heart, may it go to the heart." And yet, a lot of people say they don't really get the Missa Solemnis. I asked John Eliot Gardner what they're missing.
To me, it's a most approachable piece and a most touching piece, because Beethoven bears his soul in this piece. He invested so much time and energy and effort into it in trying to get the tone of the piece right, and he changed course in the process of composing it because it was intended as a liturgical piece, and the whole idea of it being liturgical is really preposterous, because he plays fast and loose with the text and it becomes so much more individual, personalized version of the liturgy. And you sense him struggling with his beliefs or his qualified beliefs. But what gives it so much pathos and so much emotive force is the way that he postulates a divine Godhead completely out of reach, out of scale with the sort of puny efforts of humanity. And that's amazing. He does it in terms of the tessitura, of the contrast between the very low and the incredibly high. He does it in terms of dynamics, he does it in terms of instrumentation, he does it above all philosophically. You can sense the philosophy of it behind it. You know, we're just wriggly worms. And there is überstaunen muss erwohnen, as he says in the Ninth Symphony. And it's that sense of clinging on to belief that is so touching and powerful.
Well, the leader of the Orchestre Révolutionnaire Romantique, Peter Hansen, is already on the platform with the orchestra, behind them the Monteverdi Choir, and here are the four soloists: soprano Lucy Crowe, mezzo Jennifer Johnston, tenor James Gilchrist and bass Matthew Rose, followed by John Eliot Gardner to perform Beethoven's Missa Solemnis.